Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have you with us today. On the day before the Georgia legislature gets set to adjourn for the 2018 session, so we'll have a lot to discuss in terms of where they stand on key pieces of legislation you might be particularly interested in. But let me do a little housekeeping before we start our topics of conversation and before I introduce the panel. First of all, I want to remind you that you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. I say that right away because I don't give enough attention to how important it is to us to hear from you on Twitter. So stay in touch with us at PoliticsGPB. Also, I want to remind you that we're up on Facebook Live. If you want to watch what's going on in the radio studio, just go to the GPB News page on Facebook, and you can see us there. And the final piece of business is April 13th, Thursday night, April 13th. We will be down in Macon to do a show in front of a live audience. We'll tape that night for air the next day. Jim Galloway will be down there with me, and we're still rounding up a panel, but we'll have local Macon folks on the show. I said April 13th. I meant April 12th, Thursday, April 12th. Thank you, Tom Faust. It's one of the reasons it's great to have a producer. April 12th. If you want to join us, it's free, of course, but we do ask that you register so that we can get a handle on who's going to, how many people are going to be there. Just go to gpbnews.org/community and scroll down that page and you will see information about the event and a button where you can register. We'd love to have as many of you as possible in Macon for Political Rewind. Okay, enough of the business. Let's get on with the topics today. Joining us is, this week especially, the hardest working man in the news business, Greg Bluestein. It's Wednesday. You're with us on Wednesdays, Greg. You have been, of course, Greg's a political reporter for the AJC, covering all of the Zell Miller services this week. And in a minute, we'll talk about the one that finally wrapped things up today. But thank you for being here.
Of course.
Dr. Andre Gillespie, political science professor from Emory University, is back with us today. Hi, Andre. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Howard Franklin, Democratic political consultant, is here. I imagine you've been down. You do a lot of lobbying. I imagine you've been working long hours at the Capitol, especially this week.
Long hours, one more day.
All right, we'll find out some of the things that you're keeping track of as we go through it. And we're glad to have Eric Tannenblatt with us. Eric, of course, is a longtime, I want to call you, I never quite know, Republican operative, Republican fundraiser. You tell me how you like to be identified.
How much is a Georgian?
A Georgian. Eric Tannenblatt's modest. He's worked with every Republican president or presidential nominee since, I think, before George H.W. Bush.
Yeah, that was the first.
George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Mitt Romney. So Eric's been all over the place. Thank you for being here today too, Eric. So let's, Greg, we spent a lot of time on Monday talking, of course, about the death of Zell Miller, a real giant of Georgia politics. And yesterday we broadcast his memorial service from Peachtree United Methodist Church. But today was the final day of activity. And so I think we should all take a few minutes just to finish off our conversations about Zell Miller. There was an event, a memorial service, this morning at the state capitol. What went on and what can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, so Monday we were in Young Harris for the first day, and that was his son and many of people who from Young Harris who simply wanted to say goodbye to the politician who loved his town that much, you know, who never strayed very far from Young Harris in heart and in body. Tuesday, of course, was three presidents, plus his grandson, Brian Miller, giving the 14 lessons that Zell Miller gave him on his 70th birthday, which I thought was very poignant. And then today was a much briefer and very solemn ceremony in the heart of the Capitol, in the rotunda. Only a handful of people were allowed in the rotunda. There was many, many more watching from the balconies or behind the velvet ropes. And it was Sonny Perdue and Nathan Deal. Both gave their remembrances of him. Governor Deal, as he does often, choked up, talking about the legacy that Governor Miller leaves behind. And Sonny Perdue said, you know, usually at these funerals, people like to hear funny anecdotes. He was searching for one. He said, I just knew Zell Miller as a very serious man, and one he crossed paths with many times while he was in the state Senate. He gave one story about how he tried to take money out of a budget proposal that Zell Miller was championing to support funding in Savannah. He got called to the governor's office and said, basically, don't you dare touch that money. And it got back in the budget. But he said, what do you say to the man who brought hope to Georgia? People were kind of left struggling for words after this week.
I'm interested in the fact that throughout all of this, there are any number of voices who we didn't hear. I mean, I thought perhaps that former governors, aside from Sonny Perdue, might be on hand today. Roy Barnes, of course, with his wife Marie, was at the church yesterday, but there was no speaking role at any point for him. Of course, he competed against Zell Miller in 1990 at one point.
And he was, as you mentioned, he was there yesterday, but he also had another funeral today. That was the reason he wasn't there today. And Joe Frank Harris was also supposed to be here today, but he ended up being a late scratch as well.
He was at the church yesterday for the service. Andre Gillespie, let me, if I may, turn to you. And we've certainly spent a lot of time since last Friday on the show singing Zell Miller's praises, and he certainly deserves most of the recognition he gets as having been one of Georgia's great governors. I was watching an MSNBC show in which there was coverage, as there were on many networks, of the fact that three former presidents were here for Zell's funeral, not typical for the funeral of a governor. And the anchor who was reporting the story made one point. He said, this is the man who allowed poor children to go to college. And I think now it's fair to say that's true, but also problematic. Is that a correct statement? In other words, the hope has been a phenomenal program that did everything Zell wanted it to do, but there's a stratified kind of nature of it right now. Yes?
Well, I mean, I think you're referring to revisions to hope eligibility that happened a few years ago in the wake of budget crises. And so, and that's definitely something that we should probably continue to revisit as a state. I think while it is very, very important, and so, and I should have a disclaimer here, you know, I am not a native Georgian. So, you know, and I'm a relatively recent transplant to the state, and definitely came after, came when Sonny Perdue was governor. So my connection to it was that I knew Hope because I had cousins who, you know, went to college. I had a cousin who went to Georgia State on the Hope Scholarship. So I knew that in Georgia, if you had a B average, you could go to a public university for free if you could get in. I think there is still that larger question of if you can get in.
Yeah.
And the ways that class is actually implicated in the life chances and in the educational opportunities that you have to have in order to be eligible to go to college in the first place that are still addressed. It addresses issues of affordability for really smart, ambitious kids who have strong support systems behind them, who know how to apply to college and other types of things. But there's still far too many people who have the mental wherewithal to be able to go to college who have not been socialized into that. And so we want to make sure just, you know, as a state, and I say this as an educator, that we are helping those who are able and willing to get there and that we're not holding anybody back and that we're also providing other types of opportunities like vocational education for those who would be inclined to go that route and that they're not being tracked there because of the zip code that they grew up in or because of the color of their skin.
And of course, Greg, the other thing that has happened is Hope is a wonderful program that is, you know, it's interesting. If you look at the where the graduating classes from, say, Westminster, Pace Academy, other private schools, high-achieving private schools, they are heavily weighted toward state universities, and because students do get the Hope Scholarship. So I don't think even Zell would be thrilled with the fact that in some ways it's a subsidy for people who really ought to be able to afford to send their kids to college themselves.
Yeah, around the time when I was in college, there was always these stories about Hope cars. You know, the bank accounts that parents would set aside for college ended up going to their cars or vacations or things like that for them, that ended up helping wealthy people go to school. But that also, you know, as we mentioned, helped a generation of lower and middle class folks go to college too, that otherwise would have had to rack up huge amounts of student loans.
You told a wonderful story in the AJC the other day that I think you should tell right now.
Well, I was kind of one of those. I was the oldest son of three boys. My mother was a single mother, a teacher. And we were in that boat. I mean, I was going to go to college, so I wasn't in the position where I wasn't going to go. I was going to rack up student loans or whatever. But because of Hope Scholarship, it wasn't, I had something like a 3-something GPA, so I wasn't too worried about keeping the B average. But I ended up going to UGA. I still racked up student loans. I still had to pay my room and board. But I was able to pay those off thanks to internships later on in my college career. But my mom, you know, was stressed out. She's listening right now, so she'll call me right after this. But she was stressed out at the time. She was worried about sending her three boys to college, and Hope Scholarship was a comfort to her. And she got out a pen and paper right before I went to UGA, days before my freshman year in 2000, wrote him a letter. And to her shock, she got a handwritten letter back from him saying thank you. But she wanted to thank him personally for helping my family, me first, go to college.
Eric and Howard, as we come to the end of a week in which we've celebrated the life and career of Zell Miller, we wanted everybody who comes in here to get an opportunity to tell a story or to share their feelings about him. Eric?
Yeah, well first, I thought, Greg, your piece was great and said a lot. And in addition to the Hope Scholarship, we shouldn't also forget the pre-K program and the impact that that has. And this has been this week I've reflected a lot on politics, because in a lot of ways it's the end of a generation in Georgia. You know, Governor Miller, Senator Miller, you know, really represented a generation of Georgia politicians that were not necessarily partisan, worked together. I actually got to know Governor Miller when I was working for Senator Coverdell, and back in the 90s. They had worked for many years together in the state Senate and had a very good working relationship that continued on when Governor Miller was governor and Senator Coverdell was in the Senate.
U.S. Senate.
In the U.S. Senate. I then got to see Governor Miller take the Senate seat when Senator Coverdell passed away, and then was fortunate enough to have Senator Miller spend 4 years working at my firm and at McKinnelong and Aldridge. But, you know, thinking back to Governor Perdue, served in the state Senate when Governor Miller was governor. I think he was the Senate president at the time, or president pro tem. Governor Deal served in the state Senate when Governor Miller was lieutenant governor, and he's coming to the end of his term. So it really is the end of a generation in Georgia politics. And I think, you know, he's left a lasting legacy. And, you know, the stories that Greg told and the thousands and thousands of other Georgians that were touched by him. We're going to remember that.
I guess more like Audra, I'm a relatively recent transplant to the great state of Georgia, so I don't have any personal stories. I remember the party switch and, you know, the conversation.
Well, he never switched parties.
That's right. He just didn't. That's right. Spoke at the Republican National Convention. And I guess what I gathered from yesterday with his body lying in state and, you know, kind of the reverence and respect that people had for, you know, at least a brief time when the procession came in and folks were just interested and wanted to, you know, respect that time. I thought that was great. And I think also looking back at the remarks that the three presidents and other speakers gave, you know, it's just definitely a sort of a welcome respite from the, you know, the discord and the rancor we see in the from a partisan standpoint, from the White House and from Washington. So if we only get those moments every so often, it's good to stop and appreciate them.
Well, you know, I thought we would take just a minute to listen to very brief sound from the speeches that the former presidents gave yesterday. When you talk about that Miller kind of was part of an era in which there wasn't as much rancor and partisanship, former President Jimmy Carter, who spoke yesterday, might take a little issue with that. Let's listen to just a moment of what he had to say.
I've been friends of Zell Miller off and on for 55 years.
That's a great line, Eric Tannenblatt, because, of course, when Zell Miller spoke at the Republican National Convention and really, really trashed John Kerry, the Democratic nominee, President Carter sent him an angry letter saying, you basically, you turncoat.
That's right. That's right. But then I think President Carter said they served together. Was it the Mercer University?
Yeah, they're on the Mercer board. University board. But for a while, Carter was really angry with Zell Miller.
Well, not just President Carter. I mean, I had a lot of Democrats. But, you know, many of them turned out yesterday for the funeral. And
you know, what's interesting is that in terms of sort of how I knew who Zell Miller was because I was working for John Kerry's pollster in 2004. Oh. And so I remembered watching the convention, and I'll never forget Spitballs. And I'd forgotten about the challenging Chris Matthews to a duel, like on MSNBC next day. That was my introduction to Zell Miller. And I think the fact that we can look back on that fondly now sort of is evidence of the fact that he came of age in a far less polarized time than we are operating in today. And that's a good lesson that sometimes when people evolve, and I think it's really interesting that he evolved but actually remained a Democrat because there were some core principles that he actually thought were still important. It was important for him to represent that particular voice within the Democratic Party. But then there was also this getting to know one another that I don't think we take enough time to do because we keep each other at distance sometimes so that we can actually remain polarized because it's a lot easier to attack somebody that you don't know that well versus somebody who you've gotten to know in a really, you know, important and intimate sense.
I also thought former President Clinton, of course, spoke, and we know that that was a very close relationship. President Clinton be the first one to say that Zell Miller, more than any other individual, probably was responsible for pushing him toward the White House for a variety of reasons. Let's listen to just a few words from President Clinton yesterday.
So in 1991, I was giving a speech here. And I checked in with the governor and first lady of Georgia, and they asked me to spend the night. And Zell had been to the speech, so I spent the night. And we stayed out till 3 o'clock in the morning talking. And maybe because I talked too much, maybe because he was having a good time. But essentially, after all those hours of talking, his advice was, if you want to run for president, you need to call Paul Begala and James Carville and give shorter speeches. Well, I took 50% of the advice.
Greg Bluestein, I think many of us who spent any time, and I spent a lot of it covering President Clinton, wish he had taken both pieces of advice.
You know, a funny aside to that, today at the executive funeral, I bumped into the member of the Miller security detail who drove Bill Clinton that night. He said he remembers two things from that. He said Clinton wolfed down two Big Macs in the span of a few minutes in the back of the car. And also, years later, when Clinton was back doing the Olympics, he still remembered the name of that driver. How, you know, wow. All those years later, and some inside joke that they shared that night. So that tells you a lot.
Okay. Howard, you talked about a certain kind of comedy, people getting along in terms of across party lines. And George W. Bush made reference to that really in his remarks yesterday.
He was a man of honor and a faithful friend. In 2004, Zell Miller stood up to speak for me. Now it's my honor to speak for him.
Howard, he also said that... George W. Bush did, that Zell Miller probably, he went to Bush, Miller did, and said, would it be of help to you if I spoke at your convention? If it's not, I won't. And Bush said, he said to him immediately, oh my gosh, yes, it would be of help to me.
Yeah, I think it's proof positive of, and I don't want to romanticize, you know, 12 years ago, 16 years ago, but I do think it's indicative of how much interest there was in a bipartisan conversation, even if you didn't agree with or didn't hail from the same party as the person across from you. And whether or not we'll return to that era remains to be seen.
Eric, is it overstatement to think that Zell Miller, the Democrat Zell Miller, speaking at the Republican convention in 2004, had a major impact on the election?
Oh, I think he did. I think he did because it showed, you know, bipartisan support, sort of what Howard was saying. I also want to make sure that we don't end this conversation without also mentioning Zell's grandson, Brian Miller. I think Brian really did a nice job representing his family, but also talking about the lessons of Zell Miller. I thought that was very powerful. And I think Brian Miller and the Miller Institute, which he is now leading, is going to carry on the Zell Miller legacy.
Andre, you were working for John Kerry's pollster in 2004. Did any signs that that you, as you worked on that, saw that Zell had gave a bump to the Republicans?
I don't remember. In terms of looking at the daily tracking polls from 2004, you know, I'm not quite sure that it would have had the same effect. So, I mean, it wasn't like Georgia was really, you know, purple
at
that time. And I think nationally, I think the trends were the way that they were. I would look at that. I think a lot of people just assumed at that point that Zell Miller had become a Republican. And so it just seemed like it was fitting this larger trend of the once solid Democratic South starting to turn more red. And so it sort of fit and was emblematic of that. And while Miller stayed loyal to his party, there were other people who, on both sides of the aisle, particularly people who were more centrist in their politics, who saw sort of the party platforms pass them by and have made the decision to go shift to sort of where their ideology sort of is more congruent. And I think that that sort of reflects in many ways how he was kind of a bit of a man out of his time. What I remember from that convention, since we were back in D.C., was that, you know, everybody was kind of aghast at the comments and sort of, you know, and in terms of the showmanship. And there have been since Miller other Democrats who have spoken at Republican conventions. And I think, you know, not to the same type of fanfare and probably definitely not to the same type of effect. And so, you know, it's probably for other people been more damaging to their careers than it was helpful to their careers.
But Zell Miller, you know, one thing unique about him is he had a real pulse of the electorate and the people, especially in this state. And, you know, he was governor at a time when you had the growth of the sort of federal Republicans in Georgia, while the state was still controlled by the Democrats. And when he got to the Senate, he got a front row seat to see, what did he say, the Democratic Party, the National Democratic Party just lost sight of conservative Southern Democrats.
Yeah, he felt the party deserted him, not that he deserted the party. We've spent, since last Friday, a good amount of time on this show with with one of the reasons I love being able to host the show is we have people like we have today who have spent so much time observing the politics and the political leaders of the state. And it's been a joy for the past week to have an opportunity to remember the great Zell Miller. He is being cremated, is that right, Greg?
That's what we believe, yeah.
And that final event in this week of memorials was scheduled to happen after they left the Capitol today.
Mm-hmm. They went up to Commissioner McDonald's funeral home, and they had one more private ceremony just for family for about 30 minutes to an hour, and then I think they left his remains.
So there's no question that we'll be talking. Zell Miller will come up in conversations on this show for a long time to come. But for now, we just say a fond farewell to a great, great Georgian. And we remember and think about his widow, Shirley, his grandson, Brian, and the whole family. Thank you for everything you did for this state, Zell Miller. We have a lot more to talk about on Political Rewind today. Let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll do just that.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
Call 877-GPB-1CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Eric Tannenblatt, Dr. Andra Gillespie, Howard Franklin, and Greg Bluestein are here. Greg, the headline on the top of the front page, what we used to call on the roof above the logo on the front page of the newspaper today, was full funding for Georgia schools for the first time since Nathan Deal became governor. He's never been able to do that because of the problems with the budget, with the recession and that sort of thing. What does that mean, full funding, and what are the implications?
Yeah, this was a huge surprise this week. With the state's economy continuing to grow, Deal, the governor, yesterday increased his projection of how much tax money the state is able to take in, and thus fully funded the K-12 Quality Basic Education Act formula for what we believe is the first time since 2002.
That long?
Yeah, yes. That long. This has been a bugaboo of governors for, you know, since the law was passed in 1985, trying to get it fully funded. And of course, Governor Deal in his reelection bid in 2014 made a pledge to overhaul the funding formula to make it ostensibly easier to fully fund it. That faced a lot of objections among lawmakers. He kind of dropped that pledge this year. But in his final act, one of his final acts as governor, his final budgetary act, is pumping the additional, I think it was $136 million, or the additional money into the K-12 budget to fully fund it.
Which is significant for a variety of reasons. As Greg said, it's 2002. This has been an issue for local school systems, but it's, you know, since we've had Republican governors, and they've been criticized for not having funded it. Also, it is very rare that a governor changes his revenue estimate. And so I think that speaks volumes to the economy in Georgia and how we're doing, because our governors tend to be very conservative as it relates to the revenue estimate. And I think that this is just another example of this legacy and commitment on the part of Governor Deal to education.
So help our listeners, take them behind the scenes, and let's make sure they understand what you just said. Well before a session, one of the most important things a governor does with his senior team of economic advisors is figure out how much revenue he thinks the state is going to have, bring in, and therefore can build the economy, Andra, based on that. He can say, here's how much we think we're going to take in. Revenue growth of 3%, 2%, whatever. That's a hugely important figure because it begins to determine what they're going to have to spend.
And I think to put this in the context of the federal tax cuts is actually important. So, you know, lots of states, because the tax calculation was going to look a little bit different, most state tax formulas are based on federal tax formulas. So there's more, and in particular, that most states realized that they were going to get some kind of windfall. And this becomes a question of, well, what do you do with that windfall as a result of the tax thing? I mean, I actually think that this is actually a pretty responsible way of handling. So there are other states that are just like, well, we're going to cut state taxes too. And that certainly has been discussed here. But especially if you know, given the last 10 years of having to sometimes have austerity budgets, what this looks like to go back in and plug in holes to make sure that, like, you know, you're meeting all your pension obligations. Like, this is the time where it's the equivalent of you get a tax refund and you know that your credit card bill is a little high, so you pay that down while you have the opportunity to be able to do this. So I see this as an investment in the future that could pay off regionally for us in the long run, that our state school system might end up ranked like significantly higher than some of our neighboring states. And that's actually a good thing.
Yeah, but we also did that while we cut taxes, and the governor built up the rainy day fund to $2 billion+.
So that, and again, just to set the context, so we had a revenue estimate set by the governor. But what Eric said, or Greg, maybe you, I apologize if I don't remember who it was, said how unusual it is to change that estimate three quarters of the way through the session.
It is unusual, although if I recall correctly, I think every year for the last several, we've come in higher than the estimates. It have been set conservatively, as Eric mentioned. So I think this is a pattern that the governor and his team have been able to notice, and I think on his last year, it's an appropriate salute. All that said, I appreciate and applaud the governor for fully funding QBE, but I do think, as you guys have noted, it's a 30-year-old formula. I think Georgia can do better than a 30-year-old formula for figuring out classroom spending for, you know, the kids and the jobs of the future. So I know he promised to overhaul the system, and I hope the next governor, as we get back on the campaign trail, takes up that call. Yeah.
And Republicans who have long grown frustrated with school systems blaming the lack of funding for their problems will jump on this. I got a text from an ally of the governor shortly after this announced saying, so by fully funding QBE, no more excuses for poor performance. That's going to be probably the argument that Governor Deal is going to try to make.
Right. And there's also a proposal, and I believe it's on the path to get passed to increase funding for charter schools, too.
All right. What else do we need to know about the budget?
Well, there was another big deal in the budget, which was $100 million in bonds for transit. And this comes 3 years after the governor included $75 million in bonds for transit. So it's a lot of money, but it doesn't go far enough in terms of what transit advocates have wanted. What they wanted was a dedicated source of funding from the state for mass transit, whether that be a 1% tax on sales of goods at the airport, whether it be a surcharge on Uber or ride sharing. There was a lot of different things they were looking for, and there's still a chance they could reach some sort of compromise by tomorrow. But what this signal said to me was that there is no chance of it reaching, that the $100 million will be all that the transit advocates will get. And that will fund a lot of different projects, but it's not that continued source of state funding that MARTA and other transit officials really, really were pushing for.
So we're still, Howard Franklin, as much as we heard before this session began from the Speaker, David Ralston, from other legislative leaders, from the governor himself, talking about it's time, transit's time has finally arrived. Not so much.
Not
yet.
So much. It's funny. We talked earlier about Michael Thurman's State of the County, and he talked a lot about transit in his luncheon this afternoon over at Stone Mountain. And he called out Jeffrey Parker, the new general manager at MARTA by name, and said, "Hey, he's a friend. I've got faith and confidence in him. We have a strong relationship. However, MARTA has not been fair to South DeKalb." He said that, and he repeated it a time or two. And I think, very similar to this conversation around QBE, I got to look askew at a governor who says, "Hey, we didn't fund QBE for 7 years, but I funded it on the way out the door. Now I want you guys to do exactly, what the monies that you've now been assigned to you should also get you back up to speed." So I think the same argument's going to be true for transit. I think the issue is that transit's just way more expensive to build these days than when the other major transit systems are coming around. And the money we're talking about, $100 million, doesn't get us very far.
Go ahead, Eric.
I think that, let's be fair. We still have one more legislative day. There's a bill that passed the Senate and the House that's going
absolutely
to conference on transit.
Right. That's right. That's right. Thank you for bringing that up. But with that in mind, Andra, it's interesting that the talk about expanding MARTA, about giving MARTA more power to build out their transit system, met pushback and continued to North Fulton County legislators saying our people have put money into MARTA forever, for decades, and we've never gotten anything back for it. And they're talking, they continue to be resistant.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is something that a colleague and I are determined that we're going to study empirically to just try to figure out what is the source of the opposition. I mean, my response to that is, one, I think it's incredibly short-sighted. And then two, it's like, really, you like getting stuck on Georgia 400? Because I don't. And so this should be a rallying cry. I mean, I think also sort of in the long term, if you think about just demographic trends and what the preferences are of younger people like millennials, they prefer to live closer to center cities. They want walkable. They want public transportation. Could their preferences change by the time they hit middle age? Maybe, but they might not.
Yeah.
And so this might work really well now for, your 50-year-olds, who are, Gen Xers. Who have grown accustomed to this, but there's another generation, a bigger generation that's coming behind them that has very different preferences, and you might be putting yourself behind the eight ball by being recalcitrant about this.
Greg, let's take what Eric said and close out this part of the conversation by saying, do we expect tomorrow? We're going to be doing a special edition of Political Rewind live from the state capitol tomorrow at 2 o'clock. You're going to be part of that show. We're going to be in room 230. Come on down and see us if you're got some time while you're down there. Do we think there's room for adding money by the end of the 40th day tomorrow night?
I think legislation will pass, and that will still be a big victory, because that still will set the framework to expand MARTA, to let Gwinnett County and other counties in Metro Atlanta, we're not sure about Cobb, but at least Gwinnett, to pass their own sales tax that would fund MARTA. But without the funding mechanism, some transit advocates will say it's just a half measure, that they still to expand the system, to grow it out to what the Metro Atlanta area deserves, they're going to say it still needs some sort of dedicated stream of revenue.
Okay, we'll watch. before we leave this subject of this part of the legislative process, money, completely Grant Blankenship from our Macon Bureau sent us a tweet. He said, don't forget there's still a $170 million deficit in school transportation funds, and the new funding comes on the tail of 16 years, $9 billion in education cuts. And he's quite right. Mm-hmm. Was something that I should have pointed out initially. We lost a lot of ground with all the cuts during hard economic times here, and we still have that deficit in transportation, school transportation.
Yeah, and that was what a lot of the 2014 governor's race revolved around. Yep. was those billions of dollars in austerity cuts that Jason Carter, the Democratic nominee, said was setting Georgia indelibly behind.
Okay, let's take up one more legislative issue before we have to get to another break. There's an immigration bill, SB 452, which the lieutenant governor, Casey Cagle, candidate for governor, is backing. And Greg, tell me if I've got this right. Essentially, it requires that courts, when a defendant comes in to face the judge, the courts have an obligation to look to see whether those individuals are legally in the country, and if they are here illegally, the court would then have to alert federal immigration officials. And one of the complaints about this, Andra, there's a lot of things that critics don't like about it. One of the judges themselves are saying, do we not have enough to do? Are our dockets not already full enough? Are our staffs not overworked?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I first read this, and my initial reaction was that this sounded like a bit of an unfunded mandate, and that when you're putting extra responsibilities on people who have other important things to do, really, really important things to do, that, you know, you might want to have consulted with people ahead of time. So I think what the proponents of this bill are putting forward is that, well, people who have violated trust and broken the law are precisely the types of people who don't qualify sort of for our sort of sympathetic dreamer kind of, you know, version of immigration. But at the same time, you know, it just raises these questions about who's supposed to do what job, and are we trying to be excessively punitive in terms of trying to, you know, address this important issue? And is this actually going to, you know, make the country safer? Is this actually going to address the immigration issues, the structural issues, and sort of what do we do with people who are here and who have built lives for themselves already?
Well, Howard, this bill runs parallel to the legislation that would require local municipalities, cities, to cooperate with ICE, law enforcement, local law enforcement, to cooperate with ICE to identify those that they've arrested who are undocumented and to turn them over. And, of course, there are a great many cities in Georgia that are pushing back on that as well. All of this seems to be, and maybe you like this, not you specifically, but listeners, the notion that the Trump administration wants to identify and send back undocumented workers. But this is all part of that push.
Yeah, I mean, I literally, as I mentioned earlier, leaving the DeKalb County state of the county, you know, saw Mayor Ted Terry out in Clarkston, and there are a number of mayors, a number of local municipal leaders in cities across the state who say all the things you guys have already said. One, we don't have the resource to do this. Two, we're going to operate as sanctuary cities, and we know that our economies and our families, our communities are driven by the contributions in large part of these immigrants. And then, and three, I think you guys have also already mentioned, there just isn't the capacity. I have a number of friends who serve on the bench in the state of Georgia, and the courts, as I understand, are already hopelessly awash in full dockets, administrative delays. I don't see how this works.
Eric, you know what's interesting about this is that Republicans aren't of a single mind about all of this either. I mean, you see that split in the party that you've been a part of for a long time. You have the most conservative Republicans who, of course, support this, but there are many Republicans who want a path to legalization for immigrants who are not here legally.
Right. And, you know, George W. Bush, who we were talking about earlier, he tried to do that when he was president unsuccessfully. Look, in Georgia, this is a big issue. And illegal immigration continues to be something that is you know, an issue, especially as we're embarking on a gubernatorial primary, and you're already seeing some of the candidates running television ads that are focusing on illegal immigration.
Brian Kemp is
pushing Hunter Hill, and Casey Cagle have all ran TV ads focusing on that issue. And at least with Kemp, he's trying to outdo his Republican opponents to the right on how effective his immigration crackdowns will be.
All right, let's do this. Let's get our second and final break of the show out of the way. When we come back, we've got a lot more to talk about. I want to read some of your tweets because you've had some really interesting things to share with us. And then we're going to get into an issue that's suddenly really blown up on the national agenda, and that's the decision by the Trump administration to ask that a question be included in the 2020 census about whether you are or are not a citizen. And there are far-reaching consequences. Supporters think they're important. Detractors are up in arms. This is Political Rewind. We'll talk about that when we come back.
On the next Fresh Air, being a teenage girl worried about pimples, boys, and the possibility of being deported. Sara Saidi was 2 when her family fled Iran and came to California where they had relatives. When their visitors' visas expired, they stayed, living here illegally for years. Saidi's now a citizen and has written a memoir. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. We have had a number of tweets that I want to share with you. Tams, who tweets at Starlight Ember, says, "We absolutely need a new generation of Georgia politicians that follow Zell Miller's example of working with both parties for the benefit of Georgia." Sam Burnham tweets, "We can look back on Zell fondly because he was his own man and therefore an equal opportunity offender." Yes, Sam, for those of us who knew him well, that's true. Ted Barfield says, "Enjoying this reminiscence of Zell Miller. When I moved to Georgia in 1990 and was young, dumb, and a Democrat, Zell's opponent was calling him Zigzag Zell, great man." And of course, Eric, what Zell always said, he was known as Zigzag for changing positions. And Zell's answer to that was, "Great running backs don't go in a straight line getting the handoff. They get to the end zone because they zig and they zag," which was a wonderful response to all that. So we've got a number of tweets from all of you. J.P. Cunningham says, "Public education in Georgia has been seriously underfunded for years. Time not just to catch up, but to surge ahead in meaningful ways to help all our kids." And Eric Tannenblatt, Terry Anowitz, State Representative Anowitz, wants to make a comment about, you're talking about Generation Xers. She says not all Gen
That wasn't me.
It was me.
Oh, it was Honor. I'm sorry. Not all Gen Xers are 50, and most of them understand why transit is critical. Well, it's a nice observation, but please school her on what the Generation X is.
So I am a member of Generation X. I'm not 50, and I am very much aware of that, and I think transit is important. However, people who are in Generation X were born from about 1965 to 1980. My brother is an 81er and wants to be part of the crew, but I won't let him. And so because of that, technically, if I was going to say a 50-year-old, then technically, just to be accurate, I had to call them an Xer because they're not boomers anymore.
And real quick, speaking of age, Bill, I understand you have a certain celebration today.
I'm today's my birthday, and believe me, I'm so far beyond Generation X. You're all youngsters to me.
Well, happy birthday. Happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much. Let's talk about a couple of things that made big national news today. One of them is John Paul Stevens, former Supreme Court Justice, who now is calling in a New York Times op-ed piece for the repeal of the Second Amendment, because he says the NRA has distorted everything we believed about what the Second Amendment meant. And his argument is not a new one. We'll have time in the weeks ahead to talk more about it. But let's just, as a starting point, Eric, what Stevens, of course, argues is that the Second Amendment was not created for all Americans to have guns, but rather that organized militia could respond if they felt their government had become a tyranny. And that's Stevens' argument, and it's shared by many people. He wants it repealed. That's a very bold concept.
Well, he was one of the more liberal members of the court, and I just don't see that happening.
Well, I mean, I'm sure he knows that that's probably not going to happen. But it points out a number of things in terms of some of the issues with what you can legislate and can't legislate with respect to gun control. What he's basically saying is this is going to require a constitutional amendment.
Yes.
Then I think sort of the larger issue is that we know that Justice Stevens views the Constitution as a living and breathing document. And I think what he's pointing out is that the framers lived in one time in one space where this made sense. They don't live in that time or space anymore. And so we need to actually rethink what this looks like and what our relationship is to, you know, protecting ourselves against against a militia. So, you know, I think it's an important thing to kind of, you know, point out there. And for those who are from more of the living document type of interpretation of the Constitution, I think this actually does point out why they view the document as being a living document, because there are things that people are thinking about. I mean, we can't bring the framers to the 21st century. But, you know, it's a nice thought experiment to be like, well, what would James Madison think if he were living in an age where there were AR-15s and people were saying that we really want to hunt deer with those?
That's right. But what Stevens also says to us is stop nibbling at the edges. For goodness sake, stop talking about which weapons are fine, which aren't, what age you should be allowed to buy a gun. Let's just deal with the entire issue once and for all. It is not going to happen, but as Andra says, it's interesting to set the argument in a whole new direction.
Well, he has a right to his opinion. I'm not one that believes in legislating from the bench. He's fortunately retired, and you know, if people want that, then they have the opportunity to do it through the legislative process.
And by the way, this has been a Congress. We've talked about, you know, an overall view of immigration and other giant debates for years with no traction. So I can't even imagine an overall, you know, more comprehensive gun debate getting any traction.
All right, let's move on to the other big story that I mentioned before the break. And that is this question, Greg Bluestein, of the Trump administration. We have a census coming up, of course, a decennial, is that how we say it, Andra? Census coming up in 2020, and the Trump administration now proposes that there should be a question which asks, are you or are you not a citizen of the United States? By the way, that question was asked on many of the censuses that were taken over the decades, and finally dropped once and for all, I think, except for rare occasions, back in 1960. So it isn't if this hasn't been asked before, but it has generated enormous controversy.
It has. The opponents of that question say that it's basically going to depress response to the census from non-citizens and even some legal immigrants, and they accuse the administration of putting the question on the census to undercount Democrats and people who traditionally vote Democratic ahead of the 2020 census and national redistricting a year later. And of course, the census doesn't just account for redistricting, but also all sorts of funding formulas, including school funding, federal funding, a host of different issues that could be impacted by these questions.
Yeah, one of the things that the critics suggest is that it could shift population centers, how we view population centers, from urban areas like in Atlanta, like Chicago, like New York, which Greg Bluestein points out tend to be Democratic, and all of a sudden give more power to rural communities. And what's interesting about this story being a big story today is that today the United States Supreme Court heard yet another case, this one from Maryland, of gerrymandering and whether you should be able to stop political partisan gerrymandering. And this could, in fact, enhance the potential for gerrymandering in a whole new way, Howard.
Absolutely. That's why you had 12 attorneys general bring suit. And I think, obviously, this will be in the news for some time to come. But I think the other thing that's really interesting, and I guess it's symptomatic of this Trump White House, is that it happened at the very last minute, nearly, you know, under the cloak of night. And the explanation that they provide for this is that it was going to fortify parts of the Voting Rights Act, which really just doesn't make sense. There's no direct correlation or line to be tied from illegal or immigrants who are here under rights, as opposed to how, you know, voter turnout is working. So the idea, and Republicans have been very successful at promulgating this idea, this myth of all this voter fraud that's supposedly happening in all these different places. And this is just another step in that direction, as best I can tell.
Andra, this is your sweet spot. This is demographics. This is data gathering. Give us your take.
Well, I mean, so I worked the 2000 census, so things I did for money when I was in graduate school. and the stated goal was always to make sure that you got an accurate head count. So anything that could actually make the count less accurate, I think is problematic. And so you have to think about sort of like, you know, the respondent psychology of this. And so if you have ginned up all kinds of anxiety through heated and overwrought and xenophobic rhetoric, you are actually asking for non-cooperation. And it's the type of non-cooperation that not doesn't just affect those who are immigrants, whether they are here in an undocumented form or not, but also mixed status families where you do have people who are here by birthright citizenship and their family members who may not have that type of citizenship. You know, a couple of responses to this would be to tell people, fill out the form, skip the citizenship question, right? Because they'll figure out how to deal with missing data on the back end. And then the other thing would be that if we're really going to talk about this for enumeration purposes, then how do we deal with issues like incarceration? And so that would be a radical step that if you're going to take away people's rights in prison, but then use the prison industrial complex to actually like build prison facilities out of state for people, and then use that to sort of like boost up your Senate numbers or boost up your House numbers, then perhaps we should stop that too. But if you want to keep that, then, you know, let people answer the census without having to worry about their citizenship.
Eric, this was Wilbur Ross in Commerce, because his agency oversees the census. He says, look, we need to get a sense of who is and who isn't a citizen in this country. We have every right to do that. The Department of Justice needs information about that. They claim this isn't a partisan issue.
Right. Well, this ties into what we were talking about before. I mean, there is a portion of the electorate that is really exercised about illegal immigration. And you see this at the national level. And the president's been very vocal with building a wall. The attorney general has been very vocal in fighting against illegal immigration. I do think, and Greg mentioned this, that really one of the big pieces of this, which would really impact communities all across the country, is the funding formula, because there's so much federal funding that is based on the census data that you probably have communities right now that are very worried as to what will happen if this goes.
I would think, given the influx of undocumented that we have in Georgia, especially in farming communities, that we have the potential, if those folks aren't counted, to really lose some big federal dollars.
Yeah, but I look at the states. Those 12 states that you are suing. Suing.
I get that. I'm just trying to bring it back home.
But what would be the irony?
We got time for 20 seconds here.
What would be the irony of doing this? Because you think that you're going after Sacramento and Los Angeles, and you end up undercounting in rural Tennessee or North Carolina, and somebody loses a seat behind that. So, like, usually when people come up with stuff like this, it backfires on them. So let's just see what happens.
Andrew Gillespie wins the toaster oven for final comment in today's show. Boy, for me, that time just flew by, and we didn't even begin to get everything I wanted to. But Eric Tannenblatt, Dr. Andrew Gillespie, Howard Franklin, and Greg Bluestein, thank you for a really terrific conversation today. Again, we're back tomorrow at 2 with a special edition of Political Rewind, live from the state capitol. Can you all say "Signy die"?
Signy die.
That's what's happening tomorrow night, and we're going to be there to report on the final maneuverings in the capitol. Greg Bluestein, Jim Galloway will be joining me, as will some legislative leaders. We're in room 230 of the capitol. Come by and say hello. I'm Bill Nigut. See you tomorrow.